lot of accuracy as she talks about the topic. Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Shame is an experience of exposure that reveals something ugly or disgusting about oneself that ruins the possibility of delight and honor. Again, what does Christ do with his people? He delights in us. He bestows honor on us. Shame invites judgment and contempt, which ultimately leads to a loss of relationship. Yet shame, once identified, which is part of the antidote, we need to name it. We need to see it. We need to not run from it. It shows up everywhere. It needs to be named and acknowledged in order to hear the good news of how the gospel addresses and covers shame and frees us to become more like Christ. The war against shame is on, says Ed Welch. God puts shame in the crosshairs as he gives glory and beauty to his people. Just any immediate reaction. What are you experiencing? What are you thinking as you hear these definitions, as you read through them? Any one or two words or thoughts that come to mind?
How much we are sinners still.
How much we are sinners still. Yeah, Rebecca's saying that, yeah, we are sinners still. The last, it makes me think of the very last quote at the end. So we'll go to the best part first. We are sinners still, and shame in our sinful state will continue to nip at our heels. But as Heather Nelson says at the very end of the handout, shame will linger for as long as we await the life to come, as you're saying, Rebecca. But its voice will become quieter and its claims less insistent as we remember the reality that its hold on us is limited and fleeting. And that's the beauty of community and yes.
I was just thinking, if you, shame makes you want to keep it quiet.
Right.
Whatever the issue is. And the gospel allows you to, should you accept, to expose that, the light shines in, and if you speak it and name it, it lessens its hold.
And speaking and naming it is so important, and yet the dilemma with that is we need to speak it and name it. We're not going to speak it and name it in untrustworthy settings. And so think about our church, think about our families, think about our relationships. Are we at the point where we're willing to give someone a trustworthy hearing? Because if you speak it and name it, and then you're treated poorly in return, it just amplifies it. But Francis, if you could play that first clip, please.
Now, before we try to identify it, we should be aware that in many ways, the entire Bible is about our problem with shame. Where Scripture begins by saying that we were naked and we were not ashamed. And then something happens. Something happens that makes us naked and ashamed. And really the question of the Bible is, now what? What is God going to do about the fact that we are found naked and uncovered? Where will we find covering? Where will we find belonging? How will we be cleansed before our God? So the problem of shame in many ways seems to be the primary problem that Scripture identifies, and the gospel of Christ really offers the fundamental solution. What is shame? We're unacceptable. That's the experience. We're unacceptable before other people and before God himself. Or we could put it even more simply, we feel like we could never be loved by other people, and we could never be loved by God. And we could never be loved because perhaps the things we've done feel as if they are so bad, they're worse than the sins of other people. That would be one reason for our shame. Another reason for our shame is we have been treated in such a way that it seems as though we must be worse than other people to have been treated that way. Every sexually victimized person feels shame. And it's not because of what they've done. It's actually because of what has been done to them. And I think that is the important feature of shame. We feel unacceptable, we feel unlovable. Sometimes it's been because of what we've done, but it is more often this residue, if you will, of what has been done to us. And the question is, what can God do to somehow remove, to cleanse us from the shame that we experience because of other people's evil against us?
Notice the repetition of this sense of what we feel. Again, it's not that there's so much of shame that is the word residue. It lingers. It sticks. It's this sense of being unacceptable. And I was struck by what he said, that a primary reason for shame is that we feel unacceptable or unlovable because whatever we've done or has been done to us feels worse than others. And I thought, well, I don't necessarily always think that way, but it made me think of a story that a dad had told me years ago. He had a large family, a number of sons in the family. And as sons are prone to do, and daughters too at times, I guess, but one of the sons was caught looking at some pornography on the computer by his mom, and she dealt with it well. But then he was telling me that as the son came to him later, he came home from work and dealt with it, and he sat down on the sofa and just, you know, approached his son well. But the son's comment was very telling, and his question was, he said, "Dad, am I the first in the family to have done this?" And I thought, as he told me this, how interesting that was where his thoughts went, that he knew it was wrong, but in some ways, the greater concern was, am I so different from all the others? Am I the first one? So think about Adam and Eve. Think about they were naked and without shame. And as they sin, as they rebel against God in the garden, one of the main purposes of shame is to alienate. It ruptures relationships. The sin broke the relationship, obviously, first and foremost, between Adam and Eve. But the consequence then is the shame of running and hiding and covering themselves. And yet, so what does God do in response to our sin? What did he do with Adam and Eve? I mean, he approached them. He called out to them. He named what had happened, and then ultimately he covers them in the garden with animal skin, and ultimately then the covering, prefiguring obviously the covering of the blood of Christ that cleanses us. And so there is, even in that's why this idea of naming shame and being able to talk about it, there's something very merciful about that. There's something very merciful about God approaching Adam and Eve and saying, "Where are you?" Almost an invitation to approach me, Adam and Eve, approach me. But he knew where they were, obviously. But there was an invitation to face their sin. But shame wants to work the very opposite in us. It wants us to cover, to hide, to pull back, to kind of doubt the value of approaching what's really happened. And one writer has said that another aspect here that's important is the doubt that is raised. Satan raised a question. There's lots going on there. We don't have time to go into all the details of that, but there is doubt was planted in the mind of Eve. And one writer has said, and you know, in this scene, doubt is planted as a way to discredit not so much Eve's rendition of the facts, which could have been easily resolved by waiting for God's next stroll through the garden. She could have asked God, "Well, you said this, but it's used to rupture relational connections." And So I don't want to make too much of that theologically, but the idea of think, too, in terms of relationship. Think, and then shifting with, think of trusted relationships you have with people in the church, but think of your children's relationships with you and the trust that's given there. And things are, you know, rolling along pretty well, and suddenly something happens, and there's a rupture in relationship. The element of doubt that's raised in a child's mind, even if they can't cognitively articulate that, well, wait a minute. Mommy, daddy, aunt, uncle, teacher, whatever it is, this person was, there was something that was trustworthy here, and suddenly something's been said, or there's a look that's been given, or there's an action that's been taken that raises doubt, and that's not how I used to know this person. That, in a sense, though, I think is part of what's happening in Eve when Satan raises this question. Again, we know that the core thing for Eve is God, the doubt of, is God really good? Is he trustworthy? That at core is a real element of all of our sin, that is God good? And we long to believe that he is. But just to be thinking about the idea of shame itself works in conjunction with doubt to kind of keep people, you're out of kilter, you're off balance. And that causes confusion in a child's mind, especially a child who isn't cognitively advanced enough yet to be able to think, figure things out. And equally then, you can see where that whole idea stems into the whole realm of abuse, where, you know, and most abuse, whether it's sexual or physical or emotional, it occurs in the context of a trusted relationship. Most of it does, and that's what is another piece that makes it so difficult, is the trust has been broken, someone I once had confidence in. Moving on just to the point of the elusive nature of shame, this is more just a descriptive piece, but the idea that shame is elusive, it's hard to pin down, it's even hard to define, and that's why these definitions are so helpful. And that's why, in a sense, if you leave the day just with this sense that shame is really more than a feeling. It is a sense that we don't have what it takes to be able to tolerate this moment or the circumstances. And so there is a difference between guilt and shame, where guilt says, I did something wrong. Shame, and guilt, you can clarify a little bit more. I harmed this person. I offended this person. I sinned. I can seek forgiveness. I can ask. I can apologize. But shame gets into a whole different muddy, murky area where the sense is, I'm wrong. And how do you fix that piece? One person has said that there, and again, I'm thinking more in terms of children, because that's what we're kind of focusing on today, but that there is, shame is experienced in kids as well as adults, but primarily as a shift in emotional tone. And think of children and their developmental piece where they're happy-go-lucky, they're free, they're running about, they're enjoying life, and suddenly something happens. There's a tone and a voice. There's an event that kind of interrupts that, and it can cut off this whole process of freedom, of exploration, of moving into your world. And so my only point in saying that is that it doesn't have to be a hugely traumatic event that can introduce shame into someone's life. And shame almost always hides or occurs in the context of a story, and specific events in that story. And part of the elusiveness of shame is as well is that for children, if it's an emotionally experienced piece, think, you know, children, some researchers have said that children can sense shame somewhere around 15 to 18 months of age. And for most children, that's pre-verbal. So they get it in here. But guilt, apparently, children can become aware of guilt, if you agree with this definition, that if they're mature enough to be aware of their impact on another person. I realize my actions have hurt or affected someone else. So that might occur between 3 to 6 years of age, as they're mature enough to really make that distinction. So think about, again, this whole idea of what your children are experiencing in terms of their environment and their interactions. And so I maybe think of this is so clear in my mind, and it's not a bad example, but it's a very illustrative example. Our oldest son, Jesse, who's now 33, he was less than 2 years old. We were at our home church in Martinsburg 30 years ago, and there was a reception in the basement of the church, and concrete basement, big room, lots of room, lots of people, and it was an exciting time, and my little son was just, something got into him, and he started running through the room, and he was just squealing at the top of his voice, and I'll never forget, even 31 years later, the picture on his face, it was sheer delight. He was just in his element, mom and dad's church, people, food, good time, and he was shrieking. And there was nothing going on at the moment except people were milling about, getting ready to get in line to get food. But my dad was there, and he wasn't gruff with him, but he tried. He kind of like, well stop, don't yell, and he didn't do it meanly. But I remember the look on my son's face. It went from this, and I won't try to mirror it, but it was fully alive, and then it just, you could see the curtain come down like. And there was total confusion. He had no clue that what he was doing was wrong, and it wasn't. So even there, you know, I think about, again, we don't want our children screaming in church, but at the same time, Francis is very quick to say, I'd rather hear the kids and relax, parents, with them in here. And so this, just the idea of this creativity piece gets stalled, it gets stopped. How do children express shame in your experience? How do they voice it? How are you aware that they're experiencing or feeling it? Yeah, Andrew. Shame clamps you up and keeps you from going. Again, just hear your words there that mirror so much the description we've just... Yeah, Alana. I hope everyone can hear Alana there, but I appreciate that. Just that's so key, being aware of their behaviors, what you're watching for. And in part, again, the goal here, please don't feel pressure to have to get it right with your kids, but just being able to read and observe and be alert to, is, if you take that out of this alone, again, keep in mind, our God is watchful over us. He knows our every movement. He knows us from beginning to end. Heather, you had your hand up. Yeah. And again, take this piece, if nothing else. Where are you? Is a question. Is God is always, always asking that of us. Asking. I mean, that's the invitation in the scriptures is always come. What are you doing with me? I mean, Jesus does that with people in his interactions. And so even as you keep that in mind about yourself as an adult, do we really think of our relationship with God from the angle of, where are you today? Where are you with me? And even that mindset for ourselves, I think, helps us be in a similar mindset with our children. Francis, if we could, yeah, but go ahead and we can play the second clip.
I think eyes, when my kids feel shame, they can't look at me. They look down. That's just another part of how they express shame.
Kindness and gentleness takes effort. It takes self-control. some of the time. Okay. As a preface for this, this is Kurt Thompson, who's a Christian psychiatrist down in Northern Virginia. As you listen to this, believe me, he does believe in original sin. You might hear something in this that makes you think, well, wait a minute, does that mean this? It doesn't. It's lots of sound bites out of a talk. But he's a solidly biblical guy, so if that pops up, that's my disclaimer.
That was my question. I was wondering that.
Yeah, you'll see, but it's been edited to make it come together. So.
Remind parents that every infant comes into the world looking for someone, looking for her. And it never stops. What this means, practically speaking, is that a baby is born with a particular temperament, and parents then encounter that baby with that temperament, and the parents will react to that baby in a particular way. And that infant will then attach to them in response to their reaction. Now, if I'm a parent who has the capacity to think about and be reflective of my developing infant's mind, and by mind here, we don't just mean their brain. We also mean their brain and their body movement and their sense of distress and their sense of being content, and so therefore I'm not going to bother them at the moment. My capacity to be aware of their developing mind is deeply related to whether or not I have made sense of my own developmental story. And so one of the things that we tell parents is that there are many, many variables that shape a child's capacity to attach in a secure way. But the data pretty clearly shows that there is one single variable that stands head and shoulders above every other variable. Interestingly enough, it's not how many parenting classes I go to. It's not how many times I watch certain parenting videos. It's not about that. The single most important variable is whether or not I have made complete sense of my own life. The degree to which I make sense of my own life, meaning how able am I to incorporate my own emotional states, my own memory, my own traumas, how able am I to experience healing of those? To the degree that I am able to do that, it enhances my capacity then to, in a healthy way, sense the states of mind that my infant is experiencing. Consequently, when my infant is upset, that may evoke in me feelings of being upset. If those feelings are things that I'm able to step back from and say, I'm upset because my infant is upset, but I'm not going to act on those things, that is to my baby's advantage, because I can then pause, reflect, and then act more intentionally rather than acting more impulsively. This leads to a baby having the experience of, as we say, the experience of feeling felt. The baby has the experience of their mind being sensed and understood by their parent. One of the challenging things, of course, as parents is that some of our children can develop in such a way that their first words come out by the time they're less than 12 months of age. And they're speaking in full sentences by the time they're 15 months of age, three-word sentences. And of course, this fools us into believing that they know exactly what we're telling them when we say, no, don't eat the begonia leaves. You may not do that. We expect them to understand conceptually the word no, when most of the time, a 15-month-old, an 18-month-old is only going to comprehend the emotional tenor with which we say that word. Most parents don't say, no, honey. We say, no. And we typically say it because we want to keep our kids out of danger, because we want them to be safe, and so forth. But most of the time, they're not comprehending that in logical, linear ways, which means, of course, that when they don't do what we ask them to do, we assume that they're simply being willfully unwilling to do what we ask them to do. As opposed to us comprehending this in different terms, really recognizing that what we are trying to do with our children for the most part, for the first probably 2 to 3 years of their life, is that we're trying to help them regulate their emotional states. And the single most helpful way we can do that is by being aware of our own emotional states and how we are responding to them. This leads to all kinds of work as parents that I really, frankly, would rather not do. I'd rather not have to go over and pick them up. I'd rather just say, please come here, and they do that. And when they don't, I know that, gosh, their brain really wants just go to explore things, and I'm going to have to somehow physically do the work to be present for them, to help move them away from the dangerous thing, while communicating to them that I'm loving them while I'm doing it.
Okay. We won't try to defend what he... Again, this is excerpted from a big speech. He's thoroughly biblical. So we're not trying to say this is just a matter of shaping your child. Yes, there's definitely a willfulness, and there's original sin is in children from the beginning. But I hope you can see beyond that to hear what he's saying in terms of, are we sensing, are we attuned to what's going on in our kids? And even the idea that there is this emotional response to our no, our volume of voice, our tone of voice, that certainly has a big impact in terms of what our child does with our direction. But more importantly, I think even from that, I think why it's hard to find something that concisely gets it at the child piece, but the part of knowing your own story as a parent, I found that to be a bigger takeaway in some ways. Most of us have enough wherewithal to know that the way we talk to our kids is important. And so are we aware enough of our own story to know how is God caring for us in light of the things that might be triggering us? That's an overused word, but what triggers us in response to our children? I know that myself personally, I grew up in a home with a mom who struggled deeply with anxiety. And this is a very minor example, but it's just important to know where these pieces play themselves out, because there are some things, obviously, that I think we move past in our lives. There are other things that gradually trickle away under the influence of our sanctification in Christ. As a child, my mom was. I grew up in the '60s. She was an excellent homemaker, deeply hospitable person, and so we had regular family meals. Relatives came in friends monthly. I mean, it amazes me how they did that. But the meal involved setting the table. And the meal involved the silverware and the china and the glasses and then all the preparation of food, etc. It was a big deal. It was fun. As a kid, you sit down and there's this elaborate table. And there were many, many images of warmth. And some of my best memories as a child come from the family discussions around the table. That's where I heard the stories from my grandparents about World War I. That's where I heard laughter and stories about the kids growing up, their kids even. So those are good memories of family time. But in the background, there's always this frantic, frenetic, anxious preparation. Will there be enough food? Did it taste well? Did it taste good? Was it warm enough? And as a child, I wasn't aware of that, but that was going on all the time. And so in our marriage, I'm talking, we've been married 36 years, right? It probably took me to about year 25, would you say? And this is so obvious now looking back, but whenever we had people in, hospitality comes, it's difficult for me. It's not natural. Now, I always pass that off. I'm an introvert. You know, and once people get here, it's fine. That's why I'd far rather go to someone else's house than have them come to mine. But I also realized that through these years, as we had people in, we did the right thing. We tried to have people in. But there was this franticness in me, and I wasn't even fixing the meal. I was doing nothing. I made it really difficult for Dawn because are there going to be enough potatoes? Is there going to be enough this? And finally, at one point, one of my teenage kids says, "Dad, come on, let me take you outside. I want to delegate something to you to do." Now,
you said, "Mom's got it."
But bingo. See, and there's the piece that for 25 years, this wasn't like a huge thing, but at times it got pretty serious. Mom's got it. And in some ways, let me make the analogy, our Father's got it. He has our back. We can relax in His joyful delight in us in the worst of situations. That's what took Jesus to the cross. For the joy set before Him of the Father, He scorned the shame of the cross because of the joy set before Him. And in some ways, that's the backdrop that we all live in now as adults. Do we really deeply know the Father's joy that He has it? And it seems so clear to me now, but back then it was not clear that there's something going on here that I was like, Lord, forgive me. I get upset. I get angry. I get this. I get that. But I never had connected the dots to this piece from my growing up. And had I just known that and made that connection, it's like, okay, I know that's there. Let me kind of prepare for that and turn that area over to Christ as well. What a freedom! I mean, now it's like, yeah, okay. It still pops up at time, but it's in any case. So. That's my only point, is just, do we know our stories, and are we willing to consider them enough to know how that's playing out in our lives now? I feel like we're trying to compress 3 months into 30 minutes, but I'd like to read, I'm going to read one story because rather than do the last clip, because I think it gives a really good illustration of what's going on in a child, what's going on in an adult, and this process of listening and attending to each other. And in fact, in this way, I think our children really are the Lord's gift to us as parents in many ways, that as we learn from them and listen to them, God does work in us through that. So just listen to this from that angle. This is written by a man who was 65 at the time. It's a hard one to read because it's so true, it's so poignant, but it's good. So Elsa is 5 and my precocious granddaughter. We were sitting on the couch looking at two eagles soar in circles over an unsuspecting prey. And think of your own kids as you read this. Think of your own opportunities to interact with children if you don't have your own in terms of Sunday school and nursery, etc. So we were both captivated by these eagles, or so I thought, by the undulations of the wind and the effortless flight of grandeur. Instead, Elsa put her hand on my shoulder as if she were asking a stranger for the time. "Papa, can I ask you something?" "Of course, honey. What do you want to ask?" She replied, "Papa, do you know that you have a very big nose?" I was startled, not with the fact or even the question, but with the delicacy in which she asked. And again, listen to these nuances. Yes, honey, I am aware that my proboscis is highly ponderable. If you're going to mess with a bright five-year-old, then like playing poker, you need to know when to raise the linguistic stakes. She didn't smile or raise an eyebrow as she usually does when I send a word screeching over the plate at 92 miles an hour. She had a look of tender concern. Papa, does your nose ever make you sad? Her question, this is a five-year-old, her question did far more than startle me. It took my breath away. Elsa, I am most willing to answer your question, but before I do so, I want to ask you where the question comes from. What compels you to wonder about how Papa feels about his large nose? Do you want me to go first, or do you want to answer Papa's question first? And she pointed to me. So I told her the story of Danny the Nose. I told Elsa about the day in second grade when at recess a group of the most popular kids surrounded me and began chanting, "Danny's nose is bigger than a hose." I set the stage in describing the girls and the boys and how they linked hands and danced around me, singing the ditty with jubilant glee. Even as I told the story, I could feel two things happen. My heart felt a tug to hide, to disappear. I didn't want to be me. And second, I felt the sang-froid and the bitter joy I experienced when, after four or five rounds of repetition, I clenched my fist and smashed the face of the biggest kid in the chorus. Somehow I had learned at a younger year that if you're going to take on bullies, pick the largest, tag the one who can hurt you the most, and draw just enough blood. Even if you lose and get beat to a pulp, he will not forget that you were crazy enough to take him on. I'm not recommending that. And he said, I decided that portion of the story could be a bridge, and I told Elsa that I ran out of the circle and knocked one of the kids down as I did so. Okay, good parental editing. I am 65, and those haunting words echoed from 58 years ago. I am still haunted by shame. Shame is like a barnacle that can die, but its glue holds you to the host. It doesn't get shed by a brush of the hand or by countless experiences that decode the original layers with exposure with layers of success. Shame barnacles and demands that you engage your heart, and that is so important here, or it will take your heart. It's either going to move us towards people and God or away from. No one escapes the assault of a sneer or a disdainful roll of the eyes. Shame pierces as we feel belittled and exposed as foolish, weak, or undesirable. Only love binds the heart to goodness. The suffering servant in the book of Isaiah addresses how we are meant to engage the shame that binds us. He says, "The sovereign Lord has spoken to me, and I have listened. I have not rebelled or turned away. I offered my back to those who beat me and my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mockery and spitting. Because the sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like a stone, determined to do his will, and I know that I will not be put to shame." The writer says, the war against shame is not fought or won by military might or will. We don't rise above shame by refusing to be wounded by words. Instead, we need help. The only antidote to shame is the word and touch of someone who delights in us. And that's the key. We need an alliance of love, one that knows our shame and suffering and refuses to look away and offers the kindness of God instead of pity or mere sympathy. Well, back to Elsa. The day weaved, play, rest, a 30-minute screen time not approved by her mom, and more conversation. Toward the end of our time, Elsa came to sit in my lap and put her hand on my cheek and looked into my eyes. Papa, kids on my playground make fun of me too. Sometimes, not always. It was apparent there was nothing to be asked or pursued. She needed alignment, not interaction. She saw my sad eyes that are also fierce and playful. I tickled her and she grabbed me tight, and we began a wrestling game we called Playing Tiger, and it didn't last long. She looked again in my eyes. And this time she put her hand on my nose and said, Papa, I love your big nose. And she slipped her arm around me and gave me a child's version of a bear hug. So this piece feels a little bit different from my own experience, but again, hear the direction in this as he finishes. That night as I prayed before falling asleep, I heard Jesus ask me, will you let me touch your nose? Will you let me bless your face like Elsa? The answer should have been, oh, yes, Jesus, but it wasn't. Our shame often becomes a part of our identity that we hold with some degree of pride. I felt disgust when I heard Jesus ask to touch my face. My face is what it is. I'll never be viewed as handsome. I'm fine with it. Drop it. Our resolve to go it alone, to do it our way, is often a refusal to let him heal our shame. His eyes didn't turn from my disgust. He refused to be kowtowed by my indifference. He simply asked again, may I bless you? May I touch you as you let Elsa bless you? I said yes. It felt like hot coals rather than soft touch. It didn't take away all the mockery or hurt in one fell swoop, but I can't deny the tears that felt kind. If I can let my granddaughter be part of my healing, why would I not allow Jesus, who has had his beard plucked and his face soiled, tenderly touch my nose? Again, his experience of that. And I read that because I think it paints so many pictures that we can benefit from. The interaction between a child and a grandparent, the grandparent listening, but ultimately the application to, do we see Christ's desire to enter our lives, to touch us, ultimately to cover us with the glory of the gospel that removes our sin and wraps us in cloaks of righteousness? But again, here, all the relational dynamics that are going on here, and are we thinking in those lines as we interact with our children and one another? And so just in closing, I would just say at the bottom of your page, there's so many verses. I mean, Ed Welch says that the Bible speaks 10 times more about shame than it does about guilt. And take 1 Peter 2:9. Meditate on that. Read about that. Look at the before and after and who we are in terms of who we once were. And rest in the goodness that we as the people of God have received mercy from our loving Father. I know it's past time, so thank you. And thank you.
Test.
Intro and outro. The intro, the break between it is kind of half on the scene.
Is that a horror?